Are you really digging for peace? Or is that just a lie you tell to help you sleep? Sure that you really want real behind all the stories they told. Steel remembers fire, grass remembers rain.
Welcome to the Wrecking Yard. I'm Jerry Wayne Longmire. Y'all are presumably still y'all. All are welcome here in the Church of Internal Combustion. We just ask that you show up with an open heart. Oh, I hope everybody's doing fine this Sunday. Oh, excuse me. I am having a fine Sunday morning. It's about 11 o'clock here. Oh, man, I left my wedding ring in the bathroom. Anyways, I washed my hands, forgot to put it back on. It's all right. I got the permanent tan line, shows you. Had a lovely morning with my bride. Because I started recording the podcast on Sunday, we've kind of like fell in this routine. So Sundays, when I'm out here filming the podcast, we found this bread we really like from Costco, this artisanal bread. She will make homemade, make French toast and eggs. Well, I go out here and film. Then after I get done editing, we sit on the porch, have this nice little meal together. Kids jump in. It's a good time. Become a little bit of a tradition. I have gotten in the habit of, I'm one of those people I drink just about every night. And I kind of been wanting to break away from that for a while, just because I feel like it's kind of getting in the way of my fitness goals and shit like that. I'm back in the gym. We'll talk about that. I'm back in the gym. But I don't get drunk every night. I have a couple, 2-3 whiskeys every night. But it's not good. But I can make excuses all day long. I like it. I got tinnitus real bad. And about the only time that damn tinnitus gives me any slack is when I got a couple drinks in me. But, you don't want to stay on a path like that. It's not, obviously, it's not good for you, despite what Dr. Oz says. We all know that it's not a good idea to poison yourself every day. So I've been trying to cut back on the drinking, and I've been very successful. In fact, we had a couple drinks last night, and it was the first time I've had anything in about a week. So, not a teetotaler. I don't want to quit drinking. I just taking a break for a minute. You know what I mean? Just a little tolerance break, if you will. Might need to do one of those. I haven't done one of those in a long time. But I don't really... I don't smoke cannabis to get high, and I know that's a silly thing to say, but of course you get a little high, but I don't like getting black. I'm not one of those that I got to get stoned like a gravel road, to have a good time. I hit my one hitter throughout the day while I drink my coffee and work on stuff. And lately on Sundays, I've been getting up, and as I get the studio ready, I have a big old bag of Yeti mushrooms that a really good friend of mine, Tommy Rogers in Austin, gave me. And he's from the Shrooms and Cannabis Society. And he gave me this bag of mushrooms a while back. And I'll just take a little piece of a cap on Sunday morning, chew up a little piece of a cap. It's not going to make you trip, but it just puts a little sparkle on your day. Sunday's a good writing day for me. Like, after I get done here, I'll go sit on the porch. Me and Rachel have a little meal. And then I'll sit out there on the porch all afternoon and I'll write. Work on Diwali Bottoms, work on this stuff. Now we're back working on the book again. We're making some changes in the book. Ooh, it's been a week, fellas. Been a week, ladies, fellas. Everything in between. It's been a week. My publisher pissed me off so bad. Thursday? Friday. Pissed me off so bad. I threw a ringtail fit Friday. I ain't thrown a ringtail fit and like really lost my sense of humor in a long time. But I snapped shit Friday morning. And it's embarrassing. We have a treadmill in our bedroom that Rachel uses. And it fell down in the midst of my being mad and throwing a fit. And I just about put that treadmill through the wall, made a bunch of noise, scared my oldest kid because they were asleep. And I had to go ahead and talk with my oldest kid. Like, I know daddy used to flip his shit a lot, but he flips a lot less these days. And really sorry, and everything's okay. I failed at keeping my shit together. And that's a sucky conversation to have with your kid, but you got to have it, let them know that it's okay to lose your shit, not, you know, slam things around, stuff like that, but you got to reassure them everything's okay. And daddy just flipped his wig for a minute. But I'm still dealing with this guy who hasn't finished reading my book, but wants to make all kind of changes to it, and I ain't having it, so. And it's all coming to a head. You'll hear more on that in the coming weeks, I'm sure. The book's fine, everything's fine, but there's about to be some conversations. There's about to be some conversations, because I've had it up to my neck with this soft-handed East Coaster telling me what people will and won't understand about the way I talk. I mean, more than a handful of the great orators of our time have had an accent similar to me. I think people will be okay. That's what I think. Anyway, it's been kind of a lot of production this week. Got another video going viral, and that's always the work boot astrology is going viral. I hadn't done a boot astrology in a long time. That thing popped off and went crazy. So it's always a flurry of attention after something like that. You kind of have to wade your way through it. And I did have I had one of the funniest things. Is it funny? It felt funny to me at the time. So on Thursdays, I take my oldest kid music lessons. I take Junie down to Best Lesson Ever. It's a school down in Friendswood. My friend Brian Carrion runs. And if you're a longtime fan, you know my first special, The Wrecking Yard, the comedy special. If you've watched it, then the intro music and the outro music, all that's Brian Carrion. I went to Brian Carrion. I said, man, I want something that sounds like a mix between Sturgill Simpson's Best Clockmaker on Mars and Brother Love's Traveling Salvation Show. Can you meet me in the middle? And he came up with this gospel sounding theme song that just, oh, it just tickles my soul. I wish I could use it for other things. It's just such a beautiful, just such a cool jam sesh. Him and Slade put that together and I just love it. And Brian's an incredible musician. He used to play with all kind of local bands here, but most notoriously he was with a band called Strippers Lie that played down here in Texas for a long time. And then he had another project called The Crisis, and they were pretty damn good too. But Brian's one of those guys, he can play just about any instrument. He's just so multi-talented, it's out of this world, and the dude can sing his ass off. And the dude can write. So it's a good school for my kid. I was excited when he started the school. Junie was wanting to take vocal lessons. And Junie's performances now versus 2 years ago when he started going to school are out of this world, bro. Out of this world. Junie's gotten into the K-pop music. I don't know, some of y'all might not know. It's Korean pop. And it's a big deal right now. It's getting real popular. You never know what the kids are going to be into. Apparently right now they're into K-pop. K-pop Demon Hunters, some movie. And we watched it all because I try to stay abreast. Try to stay knowledgeable about what my kids are into so I can have conversations with them. And Junie at their last performance sang a song in Korean and killed it. Killed it. Knocked it out of the park. But not only that, there's a Korean family that has students at the school, and Rachel was sitting behind the Korean family when Junie started singing it. The Korean family lost their mind. They were so excited. See this little white kid singing the shit out of some K-pop and getting all the pronunciations correct and all that kind of stuff. I'm always kind of amazed by that, you know? It's like the English singers that sing kind of North American, I don't know what you call it. Sing like, you know, Adele does not sound like a British person when she sings. Adele sounds like a bluesy American lounge singer when she sings. I was 38 years old, 39 years old before I found out Van Morrison was an old white Irish dude. I just assumed he was a black man from Alabama because the way that man puts down lyrics. I remember being super surprised to find out Joe Cocker was a white guy at one point. So the British people do it all the time. Like they come, they act and they're in our movies and stuff. You never even know because they're so good at covering that accent up and jumping into another accent. And that's one of those things that just fills me with awe because I can't do that. This is the accent I got. You know what I mean? Like I've tried, I can code switch a little bit. I can clean it up a little bit. And I can dirty it up a little bit. But that's about it. That's the two flavors I got. I got more hee and less hee. You know, that's what I got. That's my range. So I'm always amazed when somebody can just change their entire voice. I love impressionists. I'm one of the few comics that love impressionists. I'm always just enthralled with them. That sort of thing just tickles my fancy. Anyways, I take Junie down Thursday for vocal lessons. We walk into place. Brian's not there at the moment. He's out running errands, whatever. He has a kind of a second in command, a young fellow named Caden, who's also a very talented musician that kind of helps him run the school. But I didn't see Caden anywhere in the main lobby, and they got some couches and stuff. And so we sat down. I went to go make me. I forgot to take my coffee with me. So when I take Junie on Thursdays while Junie's doing lessons, I sit there and write and work on the podcast and stuff. Unless Brian's there, I'll sit there and chit chat with Brian. Me and him about to go see Steven Wilson this week. Is that tonight? No. Tuesday night. Tuesday night, we're going to go see Steven Wilson, me and Brian. Anyways, we walk in. Nobody's there. Junie's teacher, Miss Iris, not there yet. Another incredibly talented musician. And these two guys walk in. I know they're salesmen by the way they're dressed. They're wearing, you know, suit pants and button-up white shirts, and they got their hair all done and slicked, and they just, one of them's got like kind of this modern mullet sort of thing going on with big curls, and they're just slicked. You know they're salesmen right off the bat. You know they're there to try to sell the business something. And they walk in, and the guy with the mullety hair, he looks right at me. He goes, "Man, I know you from somewhere." Right? Well, I don't want to talk to this guy. He's a salesman. He's looking for an in. Right? I know how salesmen work. He's looking for an in right when he gets there. "Man, I swear I've seen your face somewhere. I know you from somewhere. I know you from somewhere." I said, "I don't know, man. I do some stuff on the internet. That's about it." I went back to making my coffee, and I think that's cool. I've quelled it. Now I can just sit down there in peace and write. Junie can do his music lessons. And my kid, bless that kid, goes, "He's crazy famous." Well, I'm pouring my coffee. And part of me is like, "Oh, I love you, child, for saying such a wonderful thing about your father. Sometimes I'm not sure you're even aware that I have a career or that I do anything outside the house." And that really warmed the cockles of my heart, wherever they may be. The cockles were warm. But then also, like, "You just threw me under the bus, kid." Like, I turn around, the guy's like, I knew you from somewhere. "Are you a comic?" And I was like, yeah, I do. I've been doing stand-up about 20 years. And then it just starts. Da, da, da. And it doesn't, look, man, when it's like wrecking yard people or people that actually know me from truck astrology or whatever, and they know, and they come up like Jerry Wayne or whatever, you know, I'm excited. That always tickles me to death. But somebody doing that, man, get wrecked. You know what I mean? Like, hey, figure it out. I ain't going to figure it out for you. I ain't going to sit here and tell you my resume. That's for damn sure. You either put it together or you won't. And the guy was like, what's your name? And I was still making my coffee, and I just said Jerry Longmire. I didn't say Jerry Wayne. I just said Jerry Longmire. You know, put my business voice on. Man, I told you I can code switch just a little bit. Jerry Longmire. The other dude Googles it. And then they both start, he's like, I knew I'd see you, da, 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 da. And then he starts trying to tell me about AT&T. I go, bro, this ain't my business. He goes, oh, I thought you maybe you owned the place. I go, no. I'm here with my kid doing music lessons. He goes, where's the owner at? I said, man, he ain't here right now. He's kind of in and out. You had to catch him when he's here, that kind of thing. I ain't trying to tell him none of Brian's business. And Iris, my kid's teacher, walks through the door. I'm like, yay! They can talk to Iris. Iris works here at the school. They go, oh, are you the owner? Like, dude, I just told you the owner's name was Brian. Does Iris look like a Brian to you? Iris does not look like a Brian. All right? Iris is a petite with real, always kind of wild colored hair. Latina singer, vocalist, has her own band, does music videos, stuff. Does not look like a Brian. There's no part of her looks like a Brian, okay? And she goes, no, I'm Iris, I'm one of the teachers. Brian's not here right now. He's kind of in and out. And then her and Junie just walk off and leave me there with these two salesmen. And I'm like, I don't want to have to keep talking, right? You know what I mean? So I had to make small talk with these jack wagons until they go on to find their next target. And they leave, and I'm sitting there, I'm like, oh, finally, I can sit down and get some work done and some writing. And lo and behold, here comes Kate. So the other office door over there has been open the whole time. I didn't know anybody was in there. Caden comes out of that office, comes up to do something with the computer, like, where the hell have you been, bro? I've been dealing with these. Like, I know Caden sat back there and listened to me talk to himself, but it was like, oh, I don't have to deal with it. Just left me hanging. But it was cute when my kid went to bat for me. That didn't make me laugh. Valentine's Day yesterday. I hope all of you that had something to do on Valentine's Day had a good time. And, you know, maybe some of you that didn't have something to do will have something to do next time, or not. It's not necessary, but I celebrate it. I'm a big old lover boy. That's what I like to do. I wrote my wife a poem and performed that and felt pretty good about that. We had just a wonderful time yesterday. We had a few drinks and sat on the porch and watched cheesy romantic movies and watched the storm come in, and Rachel made a strawberry cake, and we had strawberry cake, and it was decadent and fantastic. And we've had a lot of Valentines together. I was thinking most notably of our very first Valentine's Day, way back in 2006. So, you know, I've told y'all a lot of that story, but when I came back from Tennessee, it was right there in the beginning of February when I come back from Tennessee, and might have been end of January, 2007. That's when I was in Tennessee, and I was talking about Rachel all week, and even though I was dating this other girl, and then by the end of the week, my cousin Lawita was like, who the hell is Breck? Oh, I've heard you talk about this girl named Rachel. That's one I want to know if you're going to marry. No, we're just friends. But then I came home from Tennessee and sensed. I knew we weren't just friends. I knew that I was never just going to be just her friend. I was in love with her. And I drove to her house that night. We got back to Tennessee, and that was like our first big kiss. But then I had to go break up with my girlfriend.
Right.
I had to go take care of that. And then even after I did that, we still weren't really together, me and Rachel. You know, she had somebody, she was dating a dude, and she had to give him his walking papers, send him on down the road. And there was just a little short period of time there where there was just a lot of energy back and forth between us, but nothing was happening because, you know, we were trying to take care of other messes and such. And I broke up with Breck. It was the day before Super Bowl. Now, I'm not a sports guy by any stretch of the imagination. I don't have much interest in sports or anything, but I've been to a bunch of Super Bowl parties because it's usually a pretty good party, right? Go to bar parties and stuff like that. It's always a good time. And our favorite little bar, the Wet Spot on West Gray, was throwing a big Super Bowl party, big Super Bowl bash. And Rachel lived in a little loft in Midtown right there down the street from... I'm so sorry, my sinuses are killing me this morning. Excuse me. Apologies. So they're having a big Super Bowl get-together right there at the Wet Spot. And that's the place. I think I told y'all this story. I don't remember if I told y'all the story or not, but Breck had this friend named Todd. Todd and me and Rachel, we were all friends, but Todd had a little crush on Rachel. And Breck just kept thinking, I think Breck thought that the way she could fix me and Breck was to hook Rachel up with Todd, and she kept trying to push them two together. And Todd kept taking the bait, even though Todd didn't have a sporting chance to begin with, between me and the other dude. So we're all hanging out at the Super Bowl party. Todd doesn't know that me and Breck had broke up. And he doesn't know that I'm there for Rachel. And he kept trying to get Rach during the whole first half of the Super Bowl. And at some point, he put his hand on Rachel's ass. And I just reached over and grabbed hold of his dick. Right to his pants. Just flap. And he about jumped off that stool. I go, I just thought we was all touching each other. I didn't know. You was touching her without permission. I thought I could touch you without permission. He got all weird about it, but it got the message across. He stopped stopped fucking with Rachel. And one of her friends was getting ready to leave to go back out of town. Her friend had been visiting. And that's the other reason we hadn't really been together is because she had a friend staying at her house. And her friend was getting ready to go to the airport and fly back home. Or drive back home, I don't remember. Doesn't matter. Well, boy. I don't know if you remember Super Bowl 2006. This is the thing. I don't know why everybody's arguing about Bad Bunny and Kid Rock, okay? And I don't really give a shit either way. I don't know why everybody's arguing about Kid Rock and Bad Bunny, because whatever you believe in, whatever deity you believe in or don't believe in, we were all given a sign of what the best Super Bowl show in all time ever was. And that's when Prince come out in 2006 and just destroyed a cover of The Best of You by the Foo Fighters with Dave Grohl beating the shit out of the drums behind him. Like, if you didn't see that, I won't hear what you think about a Super Bowl show, because that was best music bar. It's Prince, for Pete's sake. Prince out there wailing, tearing that guitar to pieces in his mama's do-rag and just killing it. And then he plays Purple Rain, and this is where the sign comes. It starts raining during Purple Rain. There's literally purple rain falling out of the sky while the man's playing one of the greatest rock ballads of all time. That's the best Super Bowl performance ever been. Like, there's nobody that likes Bad Bunny or Kid Rock as much as we all love Prince. All right, so just shut up. You don't care about either one of those performers. Just shut up. It was, so Prince comes out, he starts that show, right? And me and Rachel get closer in the bar and kind of get snuggled up on each other. He's just the best. It's, I wish he had recorded that song, because he, every once in a while somebody would cover a song, just make it theirs. He made that song his, the way he covered it. And I wish like hell he had recorded it. I'd listen to that damn thing on repeat. And he went into Purple Rain, and neither one of us were invested. I can't even tell you who the hell was playing in that Super Bowl. Neither one of us was invested in the game. And by the time he got done with Purple Rain, we had paid our tabs and run to Rachel's apartment. And then we had our own Super Bowl that went on for a few days. And it was great, you know, in the beginning. You know, right? I hope you've had a beginning like that, or time like that. I don't think everybody has it in the beginning. Some people it sparks later, but you know that part where when the fire ignites and you can't keep your hands off of you, each other, and you're just wrapped up in each other. You even forget to eat a little bit, you know, because you're just wrapped up in each other for a few weeks. It was that started Super Bowl night. Boom. Super Bowl's a different thing for us. It's a different celebration for us. And we, well, that happened. And I pretty much just stayed at her apartment for the next week. And then come Valentine's Day. And she had to go to work. And I had run some errands. I was bartending at night and doing stand-up comedy. And had a little bit of money in my pocket to make a good Valentine's Day for her. It was our first Valentine's Day together, and it felt so rom-commy because she had told me I'd never done no shit like this for a girl. I mean, it's sad to say at that point in my life, I'd never gone all out for a girl like this, like really tried to blow her mind. And Rachel told me she really wanted to learn how to play the piano. So I went down to a pawn shop that I knew of that had a lot of decent music equipment, and got this real nice Yamaha keyboard that they had there in the pawn shop, and I got a stand for it. And then while she was at work, I went and set that keyboard up in her apartment with a stand, and you know, the rose petals and nice card and some balloons and some chocolate, because I knew she liked chocolate. And who this, you know, it's chocolate. Right, and did it all up, and then I went to work. And then she called me at work bawling, right? Because nobody had done going all out for her like that before. And it was beautiful, man. And that started, that's the beginning of it all. That's the beginning of it all. Here we are, 17, 18 years, I'm not good at math. 17, 18 years later, still having our Valentine's Day together, still wrapped up in each other. It's different. You know, as you get older, it's different. It's not all passion and all the time, but cool thing about us is she's my best friend. She's the person I want to hang out with all the time anyway. So we have this amazing friendship where we laugh and play and goof off together, and we both like gaming, and we have a lot of similar interests. We both love music, and we both, most importantly, love spending time together. And it's kind of amazing just think back about, like, me rom-comming my way through a pawn shop trying to find her this keyboard and make all this happen for her. And I flubbed up a couple Valentine's Day. I flubbed up birthdays. Let me tell you something. So Rachel's birthday is particularly hard because we have Christmas, right? Which all the pressure on Christmas, get the right Christmas gift, all that, blah, 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 do all that. And then Rachel's birthday is January 21st, right? Well, when you're a contractor, that is the worst time of year. So most time of her birthday, I was just broke. We were just about to eat the putty out of the windows trying to get by to get into the working season. And then right after her birthday comes Valentine's Day. So it's been a few flubbed years. Money's a little tight right now, and we decided not to go crazy this Valentine's Day. Just we'd do some stuff for the kids and just have a nice evening together. And it's all right. After you've been together a while, those things are easy enough to do. We didn't need to go spend a bunch of money on bullshit money we ain't got right now, you know. Just we're okay, but you know, we're having to be frugal. It's that time of the year we're having, usually this time of year I'm doing pretty well, but this particular year we're a little frugal. I was grinding pretty hard on the book, and I usually go out and try to get me some corporate events during December, do some Christmas parties and shit, but I was doing the Christmas tour, and then the Christmas tour wasn't very profitable this year for me. I didn't make the money I've made in the years past on the Christmas tour, and there was no bonus or anything like that. So we didn't do well sales numbers, so I didn't get a bonus or anything. So come back from Christmas tour, having spent 3 weeks without making the money I was accustomed to making on it. And then of course also not doing any corporate events and stuff like that. I got a bunch of those coming. April's a crazy month for me. I'm doing something for the Order of Dedalions, which is like a pilot's club within the Air Force and fraternity type thing. So I'm doing a big deal for all these Air Force pilots and retired Air Force pilots. And I'm doing something called Metal Fest, which is a festival, I guess, of metal workers and their wares. And these are people that, yeah, I thought it was going to be music too. It wasn't music. It's all these blacksmiths and people that do metal art and all that stuff. It's a big festival. It's happening in the Hill Country in Texas, I think in Bryan. And I'm going to go headline that, be their comedian for that. And that one pays. So I got some things coming to fix the abysmal failure that December was as far as work. So excited about that. And I've been back in the gym, and it feels so good. I don't know why it's so hard to make yourself get back in there, because you know, literally the first day I went back in, it felt great. But even in the time I've been kind of wanting to get my head on straight and get back in the gym, I've been thinking and reading a lot of literature about muscle improvement at my age, because I don't really want to take testosterone and bull crap like that. Last time I started taking tests, my hair started falling out. I'd rather be fat than bald at this point in my life. My thoughts may change later on. But one of the things I was struggling with when I was really hard going to the gym was I didn't feel like I was increasing. I'm not so much concerned with increasing muscle mass, but I wanted to increase my strength. I didn't feel like my strength was increasing. So I've been reading all this stuff by this some of you old heads will know the name Mike Mincer, who had all these theories about the negative when it comes to lifting. The negative, I don't know what you call it. I'm not as well versed in it as some of these people, but you know, like if you're doing a bicep curl, you pull the weight up to you, right? That's the positive side of the exercise. And then when you release it and come back down, that's the negative side of the exercise. And Mincer's theory, and there's a lot of science to back it up, and I can't explain it all because I'm not quite as knowledgeable as these guys, but I've read enough to understand that there's a lot of science to back up the idea that the negative part of the exercise actually does more to generate strength and muscle in the low. Ooh, I can feel that. That feels nice. And so it's kind of like a thing where you do, like, if you're doing, you do a 2 second positive and then you do a 4 second very controlled negative. And I went down to lighter weights. I'm just doing 15 pound dumbbells. And let me tell you, at the end of a 10 rep of 15 pound dumbbells, at the end of a set, doing them that way with that slow release down, my arms are shaking. It's one of the most intense workouts I've ever had in my life, as far as like, it's so crazy because you're going slow, but my heart rate comes up and I get into the zone, and by that 10th rep, my arms are shaking. And I've done it. So I've done, I've been back in gym for about 2 weeks. And I do like a pull and a push day. And then I'm doing a leg day and then a day where I just focus on my back, doing lats. And I learned these new exercises called face pulls where you pull this thing up here. I was having problems in my shoulders. Both my shoulders are just bunged up, you know, just old construction type shit. So you do these things where you're like pulling this towards your face and up like this, and it made my shoulders feel better than they felt in 15 years. But then doing them that way with that slow release, whoo, buddy. Anyways, so I'm feeling a lot of results very quickly. And even, like I said, went down to lighter weights to kind of ease my way back into it. But I think I'm going to be stuck at these lighter weights until I learn this new type of working out that gets me to the next level. And that's okay. You know, I always tell people, you didn't get to this level of weakness or this level of out of shapeness overnight. You don't fix it overnight either, you know. And luckily, a lot of the work I've done in the last year or two, still there. I was still feeling good. I hadn't really put on any weight. It wasn't like I was eating and going crazy. I just was kind of in a, you know, it was Christmas, eating crappy food and lots of chocolate and that kind of stuff. Busy touring schedule. Anyway, I can make excuses all day, but I'm back. Feels great. And I like this new method. I like Mentzer's theories and Metzer, maybe Metzer. I'm probably saying his name wrong. Other things happen as a result of drinking less is I'm dreaming more, which is not always welcome. It's not always welcome. I don't particularly care for dreaming. I'd rather just sleep and wake up and go on about my day. I listened to this whole thing by Alan Watts where he talked about sleeping being one of the most, like, we basically die every night that you go to sleep, you know, because your conscience and even your subconscious, the one that, you know, as you're going through life, there's all this chatter in your head all the time, right? There's this commentary. There's this one voice that's always narrating sort of everything that's happening in front of you and all the visual cues you're picking up and all the things you're thinking about. And there's this other voice that's just kind of judging it as right or wrong or good or bad or kind or not mean, or you know what I mean? There's this constant commentary up there, but all that goes away when you go to sleep. All that shuts off. When you go to sleep, you disconnect. You're not in the driver's seat anymore. You're not running shit. You disconnect, you go away. It's like dying. And then when you wake up in the morning, it's like a rebirth. Like you're coming back in, you know, it takes you a minute to boot up. It does me. I don't know about you. Takes me a minute to boot up. And that's just a wildly interesting theory to me. But on the subject of dreaming, because I haven't been drinking as much, I've been having these very vivid dreams about all manner of shit. A lot of them are nothing. It's just me in a different place and time, being somewhere. Crazy shit like that. You know, not crazy, just normal shit like that. But I had a dream about my Papa Longmire, and I know I've talked about him a little bit, but I haven't really spoke about him in depth. I'm fond of him in a way I can't quite explain. He wasn't a very nice man. My dad's father was, and I've told y'all this, he had a cruel streak. I'll just give you the backstory, right? I had this dream that me and Papa Longmire were sitting in his kitchen where he drank his coffee, and he was just kind of dismissing me and talking to me the way I heard him talk to some of my other cousins a couple times. We weren't especially close. I'm on that side. I think I'm like the sixth or seventh grandkid. I'm in the later bunch on that side. The oldest grandkid is my Aunt Linda's son, my cousin Little Paul. He's not Little Paul anymore. My cousin Paul. Paul, I think, is the oldest. Him and Dwayne were pretty close in age. I think they're like a month apart, maybe, or days apart. I don't remember, but they're really close in age. But he's the oldest, and I think my papa, I think there was three of us grandsons that he just thought the sun rose and set on. And I think one of them was Paul Jr. Him and Dwayne didn't particularly get along, so he didn't, I don't think he always cared too much for Dwayne, especially as he got older. And he loved my cousin Shane, Dwayne's little brother. But I've told y'all about Shane. What's not to love, right? Shane's the best one out of all of us, probably, right? Shane's just a good dude, has just always been a good dude, can't help but be a good dude, is a good dude. I'm sure there's people out there that would say different or whatever, but on the whole, Shane is good. Me and Shane don't agree on everything, but I know he's just as good a man as I've ever known. So it's no shock to me that he's one of Papaw's favorites. And the other one is my younger cousin, Justin Carl, and he's my Uncle Terry's son. And Justin, it makes perfect sense because Justin is, he's just, for every bit as good a man as my Uncle Terry was, my cousin Justin, I think, hits the mark pretty damn high. He's just a good man, takes care of his family. But him and my Papa Longmire fished together a lot and spent a lot of time fishing together, and they were just thick as thieves. My Papa Longmire thought the sun rose and set on Paul Jr., Shane, and Justin. He was very close to all three of them. At least that's the way it seemed to me growing up as a kid. Me and him weren't particularly all that close, though we did have some good moments together throughout our lives. But my dad and his father didn't get along, so I didn't spend a ton of time alone with Papa Longmire. Plenty. I mean, we went fishing and stuff like that. But not like I spent time with my Papa Clark. Me and my Papa Clark I was a shadow, you know. Me and that guy, you know, that's just the way family works sometimes. And me and my mom's not a real father, but, you know, the man she was raised to believe was her father. Me and him were very close. But John Longmire had a terrible, terrible origin story. So John Longmire was born to Thomas Longmire and a lady named Claude Winberry. John Thomas, Claude Winberry were married. She was kind of young, as they did in rural Tennessee back in them days. And John Thomas was a farmer. But he wasn't what you call a wealthy farmer. He was just about he had been a sharecropper, and I think he had just kind of got where he had his own little piece of land. And John Thomas had a gambling problem. And John Thomas liked to go bet, lose money. And he was constantly in and out of trouble over his gambling. And my papa, as a young boy, was named after him, right? He was his first son. He had a twin brother that they named Carl. Papa and his brother Carl, well, you know, they just grew up rough and tumble like Tennessee boys do on a farm. They hunt. Papa Longmire used to tell me stories about how his daddy would give them, they had a .22 Ruger six-shot revolver. And during the Depression time when things was bad and people needed, you know, they needed food and stuff, John Thomas would give Carl and Papaw the revolver and two bullets, and they were to come back with two animals for those two bullets for the family to eat. My Papaw was a hunter and a fisherman all my life, but you know what he never had in his house? Never had a pair of antlers on the wall, never had a deer head on the wall, never had a fish on the wall. He hunted to eat, he fished to eat. He'd much rather go out in the woods, kill squirrels all day, and eat squirrel stew, squirrel dumplings, and squirrel gravy for a week, then go chase down a buck and get a trophy head or something like that. He didn't care about catching the biggest bass in the lake to have something to show off to people. He cared about catching about 35 to 50 crappie so he could eat fish for the next month. You know, you just know people, there's two different, there's people that hunt for trophies and hunt for the fun of hunting, and there's people that hunt to eat, and then there's people that fish for the trophies and the thrill and all that good stuff, and then there's people that fish to eat. Well, my Pavel Lohmeyer was both. They were poor. That was done to eat. All that was done to eat. He was damn good at it because he had learned to do it to eat. When he's about 5 or 6, his mom dies. And John Thomas goes and marries this 16-year-old girl named Velma. Well, not too much longer before old Velma gets knocked up. When he knocks Velma up and her first son is born, she wants to name her son John after John Thomas, the man she's married to. So she convinces my papa when he's a kid that his name is James. She tells him his name is James. His name ain't John. His name is James. And he spends the rest of his life growing up thinking his name is James. It's not too much longer after all that, John Thomas gets in real big trouble gambling. Like about to lose the farm gambling. Gets real upside down. And I guess the people he owed money to was wanting him to sign the farm over to sell the farm. And they was involved with people at the bank that had the note on the farm. It was all a bunch of crooked, corrupt, Dixie Mafia type shit. And they find John Thomas hanging from his barn. And they wrote it off as a suicide. So years later, some college kids went out there and did radiographic imaging on the wood and all this stuff. And found all the footprints where he had tried to climb back up and save himself and where he had been trying to pull himself up because he didn't hang himself. These people he was in debt to went out there and hung him, made it look like a suicide and ended up with his farm. And the farm got split up. Now it's all subdivisions and that story, that boo-boo, it's sad. Velma's very mean. She mistreats my papa and his brother Carl because these kids from another lady, and she's a teenager herself, and she don't know how to be a mother, and she's and this is a different time, and she's horrible to these kids. They have a horrible, horrible life. My papa's about 16, 17, I think he's 16 or 17. Him and his brother Carl decide to throw a 50-pound sack of flour from the top of the barn onto Velma and try to kill her. It's not successful, but they did break her back or something. The story, the problem is all the people I can ask about this story have died. But I've heard the stories enough to kind of know the background on it. And then the judge says, y'all can go join the CCC Civil Construction, whatever the hell it is. It was, I should have looked that up before I started talking about it. CCA maybe. They built freeway. They did all kinds of stuff, but they built the Gold Gate Bridge. We used to have a picture of my papa beside a bulldozer at the Golden Gate Bridge where he worked on the Golden Gate Bridge. And they had to go, him and his brother Carl had to go do this. It's like their punch. It was either this or they were going to go to an institution, like a boys' institution. And so they go and do this. When they get of age, whether they can join the military or not, the judge basically says, well, you know, you're adults now. We can give you a sentence, or you can go join the military. They both go join the military. Fast forward, they get over to World War II. The day they land, it's during the... is it D-Day? Maybe it's D-Day. I can't remember 100% sure. One of the big attacks, Carl gets killed. Carl gets killed in battle. My papa gets shot in the back with a 50 caliber bullet, destroying parts of his spine. And he has to have his spine fused together and lay in an army hospital for about half the war before he goes back to active duty as a tank gunner all over Germany. Not a great origin story, right? Comes back, him and my meemaw are married. They moved to Texas. Things were done a little different back then when you was gonna go off to war. You could get you a job secured before you went off to war. So when you come back, you had a little something to do. You know, they used to take care of veterans that way. And so Papa Lohmeyer made a deal with a man in Kilgore, Texas, was going to let him drive a truck. He already was driving a truck a little bit. This man was going to let him drive a truck when he got back out of the Army, when he come back from war, if he come back. So he had this job secured in Kilgore. So when he come back from the war, him and they had built their little Sears and Roebuck house there on Highway 31. And he come back from war, he went to work for American Supply Company driving a truck for that man that promised him a job. That's the way it was done back in those days. A little better scenario, if you ask me. But he also come back from the war missing his brother. Brother was killed, taken from him, didn't even get to see him buried, didn't get to go to a funeral. His brother's buried in Belgium. Y'all have heard me talk. That's why I want to go to Belgium and see the grave. There's a lot there to make a man cruel and mean, and he went through some nasty shit during World War II. So there's a lot there to make a man cruel and mean. And I've heard my dad's stories all my life. He was hard on them kids. I mean, very abusive. My dad and his brother, especially the older ones. Larry, Gary, and Stanley all got it the worst. My uncle Stanley, he called him dummy till the day he died. Called him dummy, the one that was autistic. They called him dummy till the day he was died. He was not always a nice man. He was one of my grandfathers. He's what I had to work with. I loved him. I'm fond of, I miss him, but not in the way I miss my Papa Clark. It's not the same relationship. It's not the same bond. I don't particularly, I mean, I just heard all my life what a terror he was. My dad would tell me these stories of things he'd done to them when they were kids, and it was just awful. He was just mean, mean. He'd come back from that war a little jacked up. Shell-shocked, whatever you want to call it. Man, hunt and fish were the best of them. But my dad would tell me stories about how they wouldn't have enough money to do something, and Papa would be out there trading guns and buying guns, because when it come to what he needed, he was going to have what he needed. Everybody else in the family be damned. That's why I work exactly the opposite of that. So my father worked exactly the opposite of that, because he didn't want to be that way. Pablo Lomer always had him a new truck. Always, you know what I mean? He always had him a nice, clean, new truck, and it was fixed up. And he always had him a nice new Ford in the driveway all my life. You know, things got a little better. He'd go trade that in, get him a newer one. He'd go trade it in, get him a newer one. He always had him. And in fact, the end of his life, when he got the big settlement after my meemaw got killed, he burned through most of his money doing car deals. And just taking a hit on car deals and buying crap for himself. Which I thought was funny, but I understand why his kids felt a little jaded about it. It's weird that I had a dream about him. I don't think about him. I think about him sometimes. You know, that's his thermometer right there. I always hung in his shop. And I've told y'all the story about the nails, about collecting the nails with him. And you know, I just have brief vignettes of him throughout our life, fishing with him, spend the night at his house, hanging out with him while he worked on his truck. When I was in the hospital in 2019, my appendix ruptured, and I was in the hospital for a little bit in February 2019. And they, you know, when your appendix ruptures, all that crap gets out in your system, though they have to go crazy cleaning it up and putting you on the antibiotic. You have to go on IV antibiotics, all that stuff, make sure you don't get a gangrene or an infection inside your guts. So they'd done all that to me, and I was going through all that. And while I was in that hospital, a dude emailed me, and he was a historian from Clark County, Tennessee. And he said, I'm looking for a descendant of John Edward Longmire. And I said, well, I'm his grandson. He said, okay, I thought you were his son because I saw they had a son named Jerry Longmire. And at that point, it was just my dad and two of his brothers left. I guess he couldn't, neither one of them were real internet savvy. I guess he couldn't find them. He said, you know, he said, we're going through this collection. I got a bunch of pictures that your grandfather was sending to a friend of his in Tennessee. And I've had these pictures for a long time. I want to send these pictures to somebody. I said, well, I really think you need to send those photos to my father, but I would love a scan of them if you email them to him. And at the time, me and my father weren't, you know, we can't seem to get it right. But that was one of the times where we really weren't getting it right. We weren't really talking. And he sent me these emails, and it was all these photos of my grandfather, and it blew. They were photos of Papa in Germany during the war. And all these photos, he used to play a steel guitar when I was young before he crushed one of his hands. He used to play a steel guitar, and he'd play Patsy Cline songs and stuff. Not a steel guitar, but it was a dobro. And he'd play Patsy Cline songs, and he could play. There's all these photos in Germany with a mandolin, you know, with a mandolin, smiling, waving at the camera, Mr. G.I. Joe. Pictures of him on motorbikes, smiling, grinning at the camera, Mr. G.I. Joe, standing on a rock in a lake, just living his best life, right, over there in the war. I couldn't even picture him like that. It blew my mind to see him like that. I think about this all the time. If my Papa Clark was still alive, he would be wrapped up in everything I'm doing. He would get such a kick out of me doing stand-up comedy and try. He always wanted to be part of the entertainment world. He just would have been balls in. And I think me and my Papa Clark would get along with our love for cars and our love for junk. And I think I wrote a pilot show that's like a, in this scenario, Papa Clark doesn't die, Granny dies. And I moved back home after high school to help Papa run the junkyard, wrecking yard. And I wrote a whole show plot around it because I think we would get along. I don't think me and my Papa Longmire would be any closer now than we were when he died. In fact, I think we would be farther apart. I don't think he'd have much cared for any of my nonsense over the years. That's okay. I don't hold it against him or anything, you know what I mean? But I just don't. I just try to hold myself to these standards that I thought, you know, these men had set and I needed to do. And then you get older and you learn a lot of it's bullshit. And I think people do that themselves all the time. I've done it with my own father. I've been guilty of it. I think people do it a lot. But I don't think for a minute me and John Longmire would get along any better now than we did when I just don't. I don't think he'd much care. I mean, for one, he'd be like 110 now, or 120. but you know what I mean? I don't think had he lived any longer we would have been any closer or anything like that. He was a very old man when he passed. But I don't think if he was here, you know, I do Shop Talk and all that stuff, and that's kind of based off of him. But a lot of his character in Shop Talk's based off who I wanted him to be, you know, and vague snippets I remember of him. That Shop Talk, in all reality, is more about me and my father than it is about anything else. It's about who I wished we were. Uncle Larry's pretty much just Uncle Larry in Shop Talk because Uncle Larry was delightful, and I miss him every day. Anyways, this is kind of a meandering podcast this week. I hope you guys enjoyed it. Appreciate, of course, you always giving me your Sunday and sharing your Sunday with me. We got an episode of Diwali Bottoms today. Y'all ready for this? I don't know if I'm ready for this. Regardless, let's return to Diwali Bottoms, Texas. Curly Taylor's pasture filled both sides of Sexton Road in those days. Miles of green pasture dotted by a few stands of loblolly pines and sweet gum. The residing king of these pastures is the 2,500-pound, 5-year-old Brahma Angus cross bull by the name of Samson. The scent of the heifers and heat across the oil road had Samson in a state all morning. He'd rooted around for hours, pawing at the metal fence post and barbed wire and peeding his goals in the way any son of Adam will when desire overruns the goalpost of good sense. I can't tell you if Samson noticed or even cared about the dark green metallic machine howling down Sexton Road. I'm not sure it would matter if he did. The wind whipping across his cheeks and nose, watering his eyes, did nothing to quiet the storm inside young Carl's mind. How long had his two best friends been lying to him? Had Tony always had feelings for her? Had he missed it somehow? Had Tiff been withdrawing because she felt something for Tony? Is that what all the tied-down, fun summer talk was about? The Honda screamed like a banshee as he stretched fourth gear out, hurtling across the cattle guard at Caney Creek, a roost of red-winged blackbirds flushed from the creek, their desperate calls no match for the wailing motorcycle engine as he shifted into fifth gear, the throttle twisted against the stop, his knuckles white, his mind engaged in battle within. He didn't know where he was going, but it was far from them. Samson, victorious in his fussing with one fence, stepped heavily down into the wet ditch and up onto the slick tarmac of old tars used to make the farm-to-market road years before him or Carl Jr. were a thought. He stood chuffing low, contemplating the next obstacle, his hoofs making light indentations in the soft, warm road surface. When the motorcycle topped the hill, Carl Jr. had but a second to react to the mass of black fur, hooves, and horns that seemingly occupied the entire roadway. He jerked the bars to the left while mashing the brakes, and he and his machine careened through the wet, muddy swell, red clay doing its best to grip both rider and steel before making contact with the barbed wire fence. The barbs tore into his flesh as he separated from his bike, the Honda cartwheeling through the pasture with strands of twisted wire ripping from the fence line before coming to rest a few feet from the cattle pond. The wire wrapped around Carl Jr.'s body as if to entomb him permanently, biting into his skin, tearing him open from his collarbone to his ankles before holding him still against the wet clover, the pain and shock rendering him unconscious within seconds before he could even call out. Samson, his impediment swiftly removed by the accident, happily stepped by the ruined fence and bloodied young man, the smoking, ticking machine, in search of the smell that had drove him half mad this day. Tony run a hand through his dirty blonde curls as the police officer explained the ticket to him and how to take care of it. The officer had stopped them during their pursuit of Red when he had noticed the loud Torino leave rubber on the highway pulling onto 42. Maybe if he hadn't been so engrossed in an egg salad sandwich his wife had packed him for lunch, he would have seen the Honda do the very same just a few seconds before. The officer smiled at the pretty brunette in her bikini before saying, "Boy, don't I know you? Aren't you Tom Levin's daughter? Tiffany, right?" The question shook her from her own mental torture long enough to look past Tony at the cop. "Yes, sir." The lawman didn't wait for any further response before handing Tony the ticket and patting his hand on the doorframe. "Better slow it down, partner. I wouldn't want old Tom mad at me." Before walking back towards his squad car. "Shit." Tony beat the steering wheel with the palm of his hand. Tiffany started to speak when they both heard the radio from the cop car squawking excitedly. The cop quickened his step and within a few breaths had the Plymouth Fury floored as it swung out around Tony's old Ford before darting down Sexton Road, lights flashing, siren cutting through the damp, hot air. Tiffany looked at Tony in panic. "Red." The Torino starter was whining, but the engine wasn't engaging. "Shit, shit, shit," from Tony as he pumped the gas pedal and turned the key. "Start, you son of a bitch, start." The engine popped through the carburetor before slowly firing on one cylinder, then two as it coughed itself back to life. He threw it into drive and had to slam on the brakes as another squad car, followed by an ambulance, swung around them to head the same direction as the lawman earlier. Tiffany gripped the door handle till her fingernail split, tears welling against the back of her eyes. She just knew it was red. Tony floored the old car following the ambulance. A service hand checking the pump jack by the cattle pond had heard the commotion and run to find the young man bleeding and barely breathing. He'd immediately run to his truck radio and called it in on the emergency channel before grabbing a sturdy pair of fencing pliers to cut the young man free with. One of Curly's field hands had driven up on the carnage and was out of his pickup talking to the unconscious redhead as he and the service hand began to cut away the twisted steel wire biting into the young man's flesh. The officers at the scene had slapped Tony's hood and told him and Tiffany to leave the scene as she wept in the passenger seat. There was nothing more to do, and their young friend was being transported to Roy H. Laird Hospital in Kilgore. Tony turned the car around in silence before slowly accelerating towards Highway 42. "What do we do, Tiff?" She was sobbing. "We have to go tell his dad." Tony knew she was right as he headed back to Diwali Bottoms, but he sure wasn't looking forward to explaining any of this to Mr. Haynes. Today had started out so good, and just like everything else that seemed good in his life, it turned into pure shit. Memories, hours and hours of hanging with Red, fishing, playing ball, getting yelled at by Coach together flooded his brain so deeply as they drove to the shop, he might have forgot Tiffany was in the car had it not been for the sound of her weeping. Samson stood belly deep in clover as the ambulance pulled away, his lust momentarily distracted by the flurry of activity. He chewed slowly, motivation and scent returning to the forefront of his priorities, before ambling towards the group of heifers crowded at the creek as if nothing had happened. One of the officers on the scene, the same who knew Tiffany's dad, also knew Carl Sr. well. He'd immediately had the dispatcher call the shop and inform him. Carl Sr. and Atlanta had managed to beat the ambulance to the hospital and now sat together silently in the waiting room, both of their heads jerking up every time the door opened. Minutes passed like hours to the couple, Atlanta softly sobbing against her husband's shoulder, retrieving Kleenex one after another from her purse as they became drenched with her fear. When the doctor finally spoke to the couple, he was somber, but not without good news. "Mr. and Mrs. Haynes, your son is conscious, though he's heavily medicated for pain. He has a number of deep lacerations. We've put in quite a few stitches. But the good news is we're not seeing any broken bones or internal injuries at this time. His recovery is going to take a while, but right now he's stable and we believe he's going to be all right." The couple had stood to listen to the doctor. The rush of relief at his words sagged Alana against her husband as she sniffled and tried to compose herself. Senior, to his credit, had kept a stoic outlook until the words from the man who'd stitched his son up allowed him the relief of just a few tears. He shook the doctor's hand earnestly with his own calloused mitt. "Thank you, sir. Thank you for taking care of my boy. Can we see him?" The doctor sucked on a tooth before replying. "Give us a little bit to clean the room and get him comfortable, and I'll have someone bring y'all back." Knowing in his own mind that the array of blood-soaked cloths and bed sheets wouldn't be good for the couple's psyche to bear witness to. The Haynes neighbor, Ms. Mackey, told Tony and Tiffany that they'd already departed for the hospital before returning to the crabgrass she was fighting with in her front yard. "I'll take you home." Tony's speech was low and shaky. Tiffany just nodded quietly, their mission in vain. A few minutes later, Tony turned in her driveway before slowing at the porch. She sat quiet, staring ahead, her tear-streaked face still beautiful even with the mask of anguish. Tony got out of the car and circled around to open the heavy door for her. He reached out his hand to offer help when the front door of her house jerked open, the frame immediately filled with the immense structure of her father, Tom. Her head jerked up in panic as her father quickly descended the steps. Tom was a big man, 6'4" and easily 250 pounds of muscle despite his age. He'd been hell on the offensive line at SMU, even tried out for the Cowboys in his youth. He still moved damn fast and had shoved Tony to the side before his yanking his daughter by her arm to her feet and out of the rust-enshrined car. What did we talk about? What the hell, Tiffany? I'm getting calls about you hot rodding around with this loser? Get your ass in the damn house before I lose my son of a bitch in mine. Tiffany was already headed up the steps, head down, accustomed to her father's torrential outbursts. Tony's anger flashed. Mr. Levins, you don't understand. Tom shoved Tony back against the Torino. You stay the hell away from my kid. You hear me? Stay the hell away from her, before he turned to follow his daughter. Tony's fury at everyone kicking him, his whole life bloomed. He retched for Tom's shoulder. Hey, you don't put your hand... He was immediately cut off when the large man pivoted on his heel and drove a meaty right fist into his cheekbone. Blood rushed to his eyes. He tried to grab Tom, who's already turned back to the house. Instead, Tony fell to the ground in a heap as Tiffany screamed, Dad, no! Tom hollered again, Get your ass in the house! Before turning back to the young man trying to pick himself up off the ground. You stay away from her, boy. Next time, I'll kill you. His voice calm and sure now. He followed Tiffany inside, slamming the door before he heard the Ford roar out of his driveway. In a hospital room in Kilgore, Carl Jr. briefly opened his eyes. His father sat in a chair opposite from him, lightly snoring. His mother's glittering, wet emerald eyes looked back at him from his side. There's my guy, she softly said. He tried to talk, but his voice felt strangled and dry. Where's Tiff? Alana brushed his hair back on his head with her palm. Baby, I haven't seen her. He tried to speak again, but the words weren't coming. Her and Tony, his mom leaned in. Baby, don't try to speak too much right now. Just rest. Slowly rubbing his forehead. He couldn't keep his eyes open despite the need to know. Mama, I'm sorry. Before he slipped back into the healing slumber of the medication. Tune in next week for more from Diwali Bottoms, Texas. Episode 7, end of books. What's going to happen? Boy, old Tom sounds like some bitch, don't he? Funny that. That was a fun episode to write. Let's do some testimonials, and we'll get out of here for the day and let you guys get back to the rest of your Sunday. Whatever day it is, you're listening to my nonsense. Got them all right here. I just got to pull them up. Our old buddy Joe Pro at Joe Pro 3388. Jerry Wayne, I'm glad you busted him up on a Zoom audition. That was always the best part of the Carol Burnett show, watching them compete to see who could stay in character the longest opposite Tim Conway. Okay, snorking. I love Tim Conway. I loved all the dwarf stuff he did. I know it was silly, low-hanging fruit, but damn if it didn't just tickle the shit out of me. Tim Conway's one of the best. Carol Burnett show was one of the best things that ever happened. If you don't love Carol Burnett, then I'm not sure you understand comedy. Let's go. Who we got next? Had our old buddy Gene Bond. Got all the old timers here today. Thanks for another great one, JW. I agree about pizza. Oh, I was talking about how taste is subjective and according to perspective and, you know, best pizza I ever had was pizza I had when I was 16, and that's why I still go to that joint. Yes, you can screw it up, but it's not rocket science. We each have our own preferences, but we can accept a lot of different versions. For the most part, it's either good or bad, pass, fail, whatever. Sure, we might be on the mood for one version or another, but that doesn't make another version wrong. You might be in the mood for a deep dish. And all they have is cracker crust. What in the hell is cracker crust pizza? I never heard of that. In the end, it's still okay. I'm with you, brother. I feel the same way about barbecue. Well, you lost me. Sure, you can screw it up. And actually, it may be easier to screw it up than it is to get it right. But regardless, it's pretty much good or bad. Don't get me wrong. I love good barbecue. And the sauce might be the biggest key. Of course, the meat has to be right. The spice and the sauce make the difference, in my opinion. I could pretty much say the same for chicken wings. I'm sure there are other as well. Well, look. I ain't here how to tell y'all how to do your barbecue. But if you ever find yourself in Memphis, Tennessee, and you get to hankering for barbecue, don't do that yourself. Because what they're doing there ain't right. It's work. They tout themselves as barbecue people. I don't know what they've been doing over there, but it just, at Memphis barbecue, they can miss me with that, and they can miss me with that North Carolina, whatever the shit they're doing over there in Mooresville with that pulled pork tuna fish bullshit. Blech. And all the vinegar and crap in it. But yeah, other than that, rest barbecue is either good or bad. I tell y'all this all the time. I'm not supposed to admit this. My favorite is Kansas City barbecue. I love their sauces. I say my favorite. You know what my favorite? My favorite is brisket and beef, slow cook over some pecan smoke. That's where I find home. Pecan smoke, decent little cut of meat. Ooh, buddy. You slow smoke that. I don't give a shit what spices you put on. I don't give a shit what sauce you pour on it. Just give me mine plain. It's good enough for me. No, I think you're right, Dean. Except for Memphis. Memphis is terrible. Don't do barbecue in Memphis. At Spencer White. Hey, seven of everybody here's old friends. JW, I have my dad's youngest brother I idolized. He was the cool uncle. His wife and daughter dictated his life, and he was estranged from his son. We were very close, which I think pissed my dad off. Seemed as though every time we hung out, I was in trouble. He was illiterate and deaf from being poorly educated and a heavy equipment operator. Seemed as though I was the only one to listen to him. He drilled into me, never hang with druggies. Dopers are bad. Stay away from them. Sorry, it's kind of a long comment and I had to break it up. He drilled into me, never hang with druggies. Dopers are bad. Stay away from them. By the time I graduated from high school, dealing with being the oldest born son of the oldest born son, everyone was my responsibility, and everybody's mistakes were mine to be punished for. My Uncle Wayne was finally caught doing cocaine, and finding this out was earth-shattering. It changed everything for my whole life. He was an addict, and to find out someone you love and trust and everything that you were taught was lies. 28 years later, and it's still twisted. He's been abandoned by his wife and kids. He's been abandoned by his wife and kids and is starting to decline into dementia, and I'm torn. Do I step up and take care of him or walk away? Whew, Mr. Spencer, that's a rough go at things. And maybe he lied to you about some stuff, but if he was telling you stay away from druggies and dopers, I don't know if he was so much lying as he was hoping you wouldn't make the same mistakes he did and doing his best to steer you away from them. I'm not trying to make excuses for the man. We all got to deal with the results of our choices. I will tell you, I walked away from Uncle Bobby when he needed me towards the end of his life. And then finding out he hadn't done quite all the things I thought he'd done that were so bad was a bit of a, it crushed me to know that I might could have had some more time with him. And instead I walked away from him because of the things I was believing at the moment. I can't tell you which way to go there, Spencer. That's a really hard choice. You're at a really hard spot in life. All I can tell you to do is spend a lot of time thinking about it before you make a move. To really think, really lean into that. Think about the things he taught you and told you. You know, drugs can get a hold of anybody. They're undefeated. 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 They can get a hold of anybody. No matter how good or what kind of pedestal you might have put them on. They ruin lives. Especially that one in particular. I will say a few prayers for you and just offer the guidance that to really, really spend some time thinking about your next move before you decide whether or not to cut that old man off. Because it clearly, I can tell from your words that a big piece of your heart has his name on it, regardless of whatever he's done wrong or mistakes he's made. My heart's with you, brother. That's a tough one. Oh, our old buddy, Amy Iris, old Cinnamon Girl 76. Here we go. JW, my man, I'm so happy to learn good blessings are coming your way. Much deserved, my friend. Thank you for plucking out If I Could Only Fly. I was obsessed with Merle's version about 20 years ago. In fact, I thought he wrote it. It's really great to think about this song in terms of who I was then and who I am now. I felt a connection with it upon first hearing it, but looking back, I wasn't ready for it. But I did know there was something in it that was beholding. That is why I love the art so much. If it's truly authentic, it holds up to the many versions of ourselves and remains relevant. Art is essential. It is the air, water, and shelter of our lives. Thank you for sharing your art and taking us on another great Wrecking Yard podcast. Or another great trip. She used the acronym. I didn't get that. That's me. That's my bad, Amy. I didn't get that. You know, on another. Thank you for sharing your art. Thank you on another great trip. Boy, I screwed that up. Oh, man. I'm still thinking about that song. And I felt like was it Rachel? Somebody close to me said, does that song remind you of your mom? And I was like, it doesn't. That's not what that song is for me. When I talk about that song being about trying to go home, I maybe didn't get this point across, but when I'm away from Rachel, I get a little dark. I don't know. I've never been diagnosed with ADHD, with any of this stuff. I've never gone through the testing, but I know my mom was diagnosed. My mom was manic depressive, and later on they called that bipolar, and they had about five other names for it back then. But I know whatever she had, I have. I know that we're the same, that I get. It's that part of me that wants to just pull the hotel drape shut and drink whiskey straight and write all the crazy shit in my head out on my laptop for days on end before coming out. It's part of me that wants to lock myself away and just be dark. It's part of me that feels dissociated a lot of the time. A lot of times I feel like an observer. I joke all the time, but I'm human tape recorder, right? But a lot of times I feel like an observer, like I'm just watching life go by and I'm just here for it, and I'm just sort of mentally taking note of all the things that are happening, but I don't always feel like I'm a part of it. It's that whatever it was that was happening to her, I know it happens to me. And it scares me. Like, I'm better at recognizing it these days. I feel it coming on. So, like I tell you all the time, it's usually when things are going good. I feel it when it's coming on. I can recognize it. I can see it. I still haven't learned a lot about how to stop it. Exercise helps, endorphins and stuff like that. But when I listen to that song, it's about those times for me. It's about trying to get home to Rachel, because she's the person that brings me out of that. She's the person that I feel grounded with when I'm with her, that I don't feel like that other, whatever that other thing is. So that song for me is about that kind of darkness that takes over my mind sometimes and pulls me into that place, and how that's why when he says the line, if I could fly, I'd bid this place goodbye, but I can't always tell that place goodbye and get away from it very easily, especially if Rachel's not around. So when I'm out on the road and stuff, I have to really safeguard myself against it, because you know, all these different versions of yourself that you are in your life, they're all still there. Whether you want them to be or not, the versions you didn't like, the versions you do like, they're all still there. And the versions I don't like of myself, I know they're there. They're just waiting for the day I'm weak enough to open the gate and let them out. And, you know, and it scares me when I'm out on the road doing stuff. And it's a fearful situation that I guard against. Let myself being overtaken. I remember there were times my mom wouldn't leave the house for weeks, wouldn't even get dressed, would just wear a nightgown and sit on the couch and watch TV with a vacant look on her face and not express any joy or any emotion at all. That's where I learned to be funny, was trying to make her laugh. Because when I make her laugh, I felt like I was doing something. You know, I felt like that was my job. If I could make her laugh, then she'd feel something again and she'd shake out of that. But I feel it. I know it's in me. I know it's in me. I've seen it take over me. When I was young and doing stand-up and on the road by myself, and I would lock myself in a hotel room and do drugs and drink, and instead of socializing or networking with people or working on my career, I know. So that's what that song, that's how that song struck me. It's like when that darkness tries to take me away from Rachel, that it's the words of that song are about me. Like, I got to get back to wherever she is to snap myself out of that. I got to talk to her. I got to hear her voice. She's my ground. Anyways, thank you for the great comments. Great testimonials. Let's get this thing wrapped up and get the hell out of here. How about that? How about that? Catch me outside. How about that? I meet, especially in my line of work, what I do, I meet a lot of men who are trapped by the expectations of others. Men who have spent their entire adult lives measuring themselves against the men who raised them. Whether those men really stood on the pedestals we put them on or not is irrelevant. That image, real or perceived, gets hardwired into you and me. I'm not talking out of turn. I'm speaking from the perspective of a man who's felt weighed down, whose burdens also included the very large shadows of men I thought could do no wrong. Time and age can be cruel in that respect. As you get older and face your own difficulties, you may find yourself questioning some of their lessons, questioning their myth, and finding the standard they set impossible to achieve. Measuring your value against the past will always leave you feeling empty. I spent one short lifetime already living like that. When I say I know, I know. And if you're struggling with that, I just want to be the one to tell you that it's okay to break away. You don't have to carry the weight of those men the rest of your life. You're not living their life in their time. You're here now. Present in the world and machinations we have to work with now. You have to determine your own legacy. Will you be remembered for kindness and strength in the face of adversity? Because the two go hand in hand. You can't truly be capable of one without the other. Will you be a thoughtful person amid chaos, willing to wade into deep, fast waters into your own mind to determine how much of yourself is truly you and how much was shaped by others? Or will your life be a strict adherence to a set of protocols someone else determined for you? People who have never faced the same challenges you have. Whatever you choose, I hope you make that choice based on what you need, not what others expect. The parts of my life I've spent believing in myself and what I'm doing have been far happier and far more peaceful than the long stretches I've spent living to meet other people's expectations. I'm rooting for you. Every week I tell you that, and I mean it every week. I'm rooting for you. I'm JW, and I love you. I got that song Titanium stuck in my head. Not because of that song, because I saw a darts championship somewhere over in some big darts championship that was televised. And one of the, like, the champion dart guy, the champion, I don't know what you call a dart player, just a dart player maybe, champion darter. He came out to Titanium and the crowd was just going nuts. And it was like a WWE event. And he was just like singing, had his arms out, and he was just living his best life. Titanium. And I was like, bro, man, I did not know darts got down like that. I might have to watch some darts. It's crazy for me to come out to a walk-up like that and then go over there and go. Stoop. Like, how do you go from that to that? Ooh, that tickles the shit out of me. For sure. I wish I knew what it was. I'd tell y'all to look it up. Somewhere where darts is a bigger deal than it is in Texas, there was a big championship. I've often found myself wondering about that, though. Like, what's it like when you are, I don't want to call it odd because that sounds pretentious and shitty, but, you know, there's in North America, we have popular, you know, in the United States, we have popular sports. We have football and baseball and basketball. And those big deals, you know, those are the big, I would say that's probably the big three, right? And then you get into all the various racing, automotive racing, horse racing, all that stuff. I'm not a sports guy. I follow racing and I pretty much just follow dirt track racing. That's all. I keep up with the sprint cars and I keep up with the late models. I don't have a marginal interest in rally racing, but I don't know much about it. I just think it's cool. But I know overseas in different countries, you have different sports that are more popular. Of course, I know into the rest of the world, soccer is called football, except maybe in Mexico. But everywhere else, it's football. And it's, my buddy used to make a joke, it's been a sport longer than y'all have been a country. They were like, yeah, nah, soccer, blah, blah, blah. Right? But I know football is a big deal. Like, I know about Manchester United, and I know about these football clubs in Europe, and I know that's the big, and the chants and the singing and stuff. I hope to, even though I'm not a sports guy, I hope to experience one of those football games one day. I would like to go to, you know, one of like a Manchester United game or something. I think that would be kind of cool. Just one of the old clubs where there's still a lot of tradition. I think that would be an interesting thing to witness as a human being. But I wonder what it's like when you're like the king of a sport that's not all that popular. And then like the Olympics right now, the curling guys, like if you're the greatest curler in Canada, what's your life like after the Olympics? Are there sponsorship deals? Surely there is. Maybe it's a car dealership or something. I don't know. I'm sure. I mean, you're probably not getting on the Wheaties box. Maybe, getting on the Wheaties. Do they still make Wheaties? I don't know. I don't know if the curler guy's getting the same sponsorships Michael Phelps was. But if you're the greatest curler in all of Canada, I mean, are you still kind of treated like a rock star when you pull up to the bar, right? People are like, oh, shit. Man, show us how you do it. Show you. People bring out their curling stones for you to autograph. Like, that's got to be interesting to witness. Anyways, that's crazy shit my brain thinks about. As always, I love y'all. I love y'all, I love y'all, I love y'all. Thank you so much for spending your Sunday with me. I look forward to whatever the rest of this season might bring us. And I look forward to finding out what's going to happen to Wally Bottoms. I'm dying to know who the hell killed Tony. And and I want to know who Tiffany had a kid with, right? And she go away to college, and how long is it going to take Carl Jr. to come back? That's a bad accident, you know? We know he's okay because he becomes a cop later on, but whew, I bet that boy got some marks on him. I bet that boy got some marks on him. And is what happened between him and Tony, is that enough to cause all the breakup of these three friends? It's all a misunderstanding right now. Is that enough to do the damage that has been done that leads them all estranged? I'm dying to know. I hope you are too. You guys, y'all be safety. I'll see you next weekend. Maybe we'll find some more out. I am Titania.